Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody tonight to another episode of Author's Corner, and we are thrilled to have back with us the author of the Bluebells of Scotland Chronicles, Laura Vosica. It's been
Hello.
2 years since we talked to her, and Laura, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
I'm just thrilled to hear what you've been doing in the last 2 years since we talked last. But the first thing is, everybody, Laura is in Minnesota, so we were just talking how she's surviving the vortex this year.
Yeah, how it's climbed all the way up to -3. It's warm. People are out in their shorts now.
It's a heat wave.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, let's start with the Bluebell Chronicles. Tell us a little bit about how that came about, what kind of an overcap of the series, and then we can get into talking about what it was like to write a whole series. How do you stay on top of that? So let's just start with what the Bluebells of Scotland Chronicles are.
Okay. Well, it was originally intended to be a standalone book, and but it ended up being a trilogy told in 5 books, all of which makes sense, right? And so it's the story of this very, let's call him a troubled young man. He's a brilliant musician. He's very charismatic. He's young. He's 24 when the series starts. And he has just made himself and the orchestra he plays for a pile of money. But he's got a lot of issues because of some things that happened in his past that we find out about later. And so he's making all this money for the orchestra, but he's also causing them a lot of trouble because he's hitting on all the women and he's throwing wild parties and he's gambling and he's getting drunk all the time. And so they can't really keep him because he's causing so much trouble, but they can't really get rid of him because he's making them so much money. And so go on tour in Scotland, and his girlfriend finally has enough, and they go up for a picnic at the top of a medieval tower, kind of a ruin, semi-ruin. And she finally gets mad enough, and she walks off and leaves him up there. And he wakes up in the wrong century. So he wakes up, and he doesn't realize that first because he thinks it's all reenactors. And in the meantime, there is a young guy from the 1300s who has also gone to sleep at the top of this tower, and he wakes up in the wrong century. And they look exactly like each other, and so they're mistaken for each other, and get caught in each other's lives. And so as the series goes on, we see Sean, the young musician, his name's Sean, he's a trombonist, and we see him make a lot of changes as he lives this life in medieval Scotland, and eventually he's spending quite a bit of time with Neil Campbell, who is the Highlander who makes the time switch. And so we learn a lot about medieval Scotland and about the wars of Robert the Bruce, and we see why Sean is the way he is and some of the things that happened. And so it's sort of it's time travel, obviously. It's adventure. It's a little bit of romance. It's a little bit of a story of redemption, of how we end up the way we are, the choices we make, things like that, and the question of can you finally decide to change. And so Sean does make a lot of changes, and I'll stop so as not to give any spoilers, but but essentially it's a time travel story to medieval Scotland. And then I think go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so there's 5 books, so kind of give us a little time capsule, mm-hmm. or I guess a synopsis of each of the books.
Okay, so book one is where Sean and Neil make this switch, and the whole story of book one is that Neil is in modern Scotland, and he's trying, obviously he figures out right away, he's not in his own time, to him it's obvious, and So he is mistaken for Sean, and he is ordered by the conductor, you know, you're going to be fired if you don't play this concert, because it's a sellout concert, you know, and you've caused so much trouble, and I'm fed up. I'm going to fire you. And Neil, being a medieval man, has no clue what it means to be fired. He thinks he's going to be, you know, set on fire, burned at the stake or something. And so he's kind of worried, and he's got to figure out how to appease this man, because he can't play a trombone, but he can play a harp. And so he manages to play this concert while he's trying to kind of get back on the good side of all these people who are angry at Sean, because he's kind of screwed everybody over, you know, he's done a lot of horrible things. And so bit by bit, because he's a really good guy, he's noble and upstanding, he manages to win people over and get their help. And he learns that the Scots were completely decimated at the Battle of Bannockburn, which is sort of, well, it's the battle that this first book centers around. And so he does all this research. He gets help from people, from Sean's girlfriend, and he figures out what went wrong at the Battle of Bannockburn and why the Scots lost. And he figures out how he thinks the time switch happened, and he manages to cross back on every year in Scotland. There is a reenactment. Actually, this is kind of funny. At the time I started writing this series in 2005, and it was published, the first book was published 2009, at that time, there was a reenactment every single year. And a year or two after I published the book, they quit doing this. And I was like, oh, no, now my book isn't, factual anymore, because this reenactment no longer happens. But then in, what year was it? It must have been 2014, on the 700th anniversary, they decided, you know, we have to start doing this again. And I believe it was 2014. I actually was able to be there for the reenactment. So that was really cool. And so in my story, what happens is when the reenactment happens, the times start to overlap with the reenactors and the actual warriors. And so Neil manages to switch back to his own time then. But Sean does a good deed, and it costs him his chance to run to Amy, his girlfriend, and the police that he can see and get back to his own time. Book one, they manage to save Scotland and turn the tide of battle. Book two and three are both the 2 years that Sean is caught in medieval Scotland. And so he and Neil have to live as the same person, because they look exactly alike. And the laird of the castle is called Glenmirrell. And the laird of Glenmirrell, who is Neil's laird, can't explain this stranger. And so he tells him, you have to just both be Neil. And so we go through in these two books, 2 years, we go through all their adventures as they keep trying to figure out a way to get Sean home. And they have a few attempts that fail. And he ends up fighting with James Douglas, who, if you know Scottish history at all, and you're about to, James Douglas was just quite an amazing man. He was Robert the Bruce's right-hand man. And I believe if the Outlaw King, I don't know if it's still big right now. It was just a few months ago. And so anybody who's watched that, you'll see James Douglas in that. And he was an amazing man. And so Sean and Neil end up fighting with him, fighting with Robert the Bruce. And once again, as Sean is learning all these things about life in medieval Scotland, his perspective really changes. So, for instance, there is a scene where they are sent to raise troops for Robert the Bruce, and he has to go to this home. They're basically peasants, and they have to tell the family, we need your boys to come and fight for Robert the Bruce. And Sean is just, he's having a really hard time, because he's been very self-centered, as we first see him in book one. And all of a sudden, here he is, you know, he's looking at this kid who is maybe 14 years old. And he's thinking about what the 14-year-olds in our time are doing. And So then anyway, we get to books 4 and 5. And books 4 and 5 are when he has managed to make the cross home. And the question is, all these changes he's made to become a better man, is he going to be able to hang on to them when he gets back to this life that he had with money and power? And he gets back to modern Scotland and then to modern America, and things just aren't really going according to his plan. And he has to face some things. We have found out that one of the reasons he's gone so off the rails is because his father was a very, very good man and always helping other people, always putting himself out there. And one of these people that he tried to help ended up killing him. And so this is why Sean just thinks life is about having fun. I'm not going to put myself out there and help anyone because look what happened to my dad. And So in books 4 and 5, there is one thing I skipped over that's actually very important. A medieval madman has accidentally made the cross to modern Scotland. And so there is a whole story about that, about how he discovers there is a prophecy and a blessing in which Sean and Amy have a son, an infant son. And this evil Simon Beaumont discovers that the infant James is going to grow up to kill him. And so he's going after James. And so we have in book, it must be book 4, Sean and Simon Beaumont are both in modern Scotland together. And so Sean doesn't know why this crazy man is coming after Amy and coming after his son James and attacking his mother. So there's kind of a question he has to deal with. And finally, Simon ends up back in his own time. And we've got this monk, this elderly monk, Eamon, who sort of sees across all these times. And I had a lot of fun with him. And so book 5, Sean has come to terms with the things that happened in his past. He's had to face the fact that a lot of people have had to forgive him all the things he's done. He's had to face the fact that his behavior has resulted in one of his best friends drunk driving and ending up dead. And so he really has to come to terms with all this time he's hated this person who killed his father. He has to look at what happened in his life. He has to face that people had to forgive him. He has to think about, how do I forgive somebody who did something so terrible? And so it's... in a lot of ways, it's kind of a deep story. It really digs into the struggles we have in life and really hard things like facing our own failures and the people we have to forgive and the people who have to forgive us. But at the same time, and it's very historical, just about everything in these books is as 100% historical as I can make it. Apart from time travel. And who knows, maybe that is. So anyway, I like to think it's also kind of a light and humorous story. You know, I've had a lot of fun with Sean. People love him because parties and he's generous, you know, so I've tried to bring out too the fact that people have good qualities and they have bad qualities and they're not all good and they're not all bad. And so, you know, his good side is he's very generous and he's funny and he's fun to be around and he throws these great parties and, you know, he really does treat people like they matter and until he has this selfish moment. I've had a lot of fun with it. And then at the end of book 5, you know, we really come down to the crux of the matter that Sean has to make a very difficult decision, and we do see, is he really fully redeemed or not? Or is he going to retain some of these selfish aspects? So, and that covers the whole series.
How did you, in writing that, and so everybody knows, these books are not thin books. They're 300-500 pages. So
they are
all straight.
Oh my gosh. By ripping out lots of hair. I don't know. There might have been some wine involved at some of the more desperate moments. It's a challenge. It's a challenge. I had to go back and reread them and do a lot of spot checking. I went through many, many, many drafts of them, and I've often kind of said it's like wrestling a 12-armed octopus that you're going through and you go, oops, you know, that doesn't make sense. I have to fix it. And so you fix it, completely forgetting that it affects something else. And so on the next three, you go, oh my gosh, you know, I fixed that. Now these three things that happened earlier don't make sense. So you have to keep going through over and over and over. And it's very time consuming. So I know people who are putting out a book every 6 to 8 weeks. And I, on the other hand, am doing pretty well if I can get the next book written in 2 years. So that's, you know, I just have to face that it's going to take me longer because they are thick books and there's a lot to them.
Well, there's the historical research too. I mean, how do you approach your research when you're, because I know like Diana Gabaldon takes her 5 years to write a book because of the research, and I compare your books to hers, and I think you're on the same level as she is, and the research that you've done in your books is very evident. Tell us about that process.
Well, let me see. When I first started writing this, I wrote it as the National Novel Writing Month in November of 2005, so I actually cranked out the first book in 27 days because I started treating it late. And I think I finished at, in fact, I know I finished at 53,000 words. And by the time I finished editing it, which took about a year and a half, it was up to, I believe the first book is maybe about 105,000 words. It might be longer. I might be wrong on that. But it's at least 105,000 words. And in that 18 months, I realized, well, I really realized how important research is. I did things like, okay, I had watched Braveheart, which is about William Wallace, and that whole story takes place, I want to say, 9 years. William Wallace was executed in 1305, I think. I want to say August 26, 1305. And my story picks up in June of 1314. So, but it's all a connected story. William Wallace is sort of the preliminary to Bannockburn. So anyway, I watched Braveheart, and so I just went through my book, and they were all wearing kilts. I knew they didn't have blue paint. But as I started doing the research, I realized, wait a second, Braveheart really, in some ways, was not historically accurate. In a lot of ways, it was. But I started really digging into the details. At the time I started, I did not even know if there were canon or not in that year. And I think canon came in maybe about 30, 40 years after the time I was writing. I realized as I'm writing about clothing, I don't know if they had buttons or not. Well, I found out in those years they didn't, the exact years I'm writing in. So the research involves probably thousands of hours on the internet, hundreds upon hundreds of sites. It involves going to forums and asking people questions. It involves, in fact, I just cleaned out my office today, and I'm sitting here in the middle of, I'm guessing that I have at least 100 books on Scotland and Scottish history, quite possibly more. I actually keep a blog called Word a Day, and so I did study the Gaelic language to get a feel for how Neil and Aline and everybody in medieval Scotland would speak. So I'm not going to say I'm fluent in Gaelic, not even close, but I actually can speak and read some Gaelic. And part of the reason I did that is because when you study another language, language affects how we, and so they have a different word order, which affects even how Scots is spoken today because of where it came from. they have idioms that we don't have that are kind of enlightening. And so I did study the Gaelic language. I've been to Scotland 5 times. And so every time I go, I plan it around the themes that are in the book that either I've already written or I'm planning to write. So when you read about these places, like let's say Eden Court Theater, if you read the first book, and I think you have you read all 5 of them?
No, I'm still trying to catch up on first books for a lot of the authors, and I haven't even had a chance to get to sequels because I've got so many authors that I'm trying to read their first book first. But as I said to you, your books are one of my favorites, and I'm very anxious to get back into them.
Well, in the first book, I don't know if you remember Eden Court Theater, when the orchestra first gets there, that's where they're performing. And so the first time I went to Scotland, I went to Inverness, I went to Eden Court Theater, I kind of figuratively speaking knocked on their door and asked, would you be willing, I told them what I was doing, that I'm writing a book and this orchestra plays in Eden Court Theater, would you be willing to give me a tour of everything, including the backstage, including the green rooms, everything. And the woman, her name was Judith, she was very nice, and she kind of looked a little bit concerned, and she said, well, I would very much love to, I'd be happy to, but I can't do it today because Prince Andrew is here getting his tour.
Oh, wow.
You come back tomorrow. And so I did go back tomorrow. I did not insist on being given a tour with Prince Andrew. And I went back the next day, and she took me all over. She did take me backstage. She took me to the green room. She took me to, down these stairs into the basements underneath. And it was just really neat. So when you read the book, right, you all the readers out there who are going to run and buy the book, when you read about Eden Theater and the cinder block walls, the exit signs, I mean, right down to the light bulbs, you're reading about what I saw there. So I did go to every place I could possibly go. I borrowed my brother-in-law's medieval style leather boots, and I went and I climbed mountains because Sean ends up climbing mountains for 4 days on this trek he sent on, and he would have been wearing leather boots, so I put on leather boots and I climbed hills. I was extremely sore. I heard very so I
anything
there's a
for
scene
the craft.
Right. Well, there is a scene where Sean fights a wolf. I confess I did not go quite that far. I did not fight any wolves. But, you know, I had to just imagine, what does it feel like if a wolf scrapes its claw down your thigh? But pretty much every place I could go, I did. The castle, Glenmiril, is based on Castle Urquhart, which sits on the shore of Loch Ness. And so I think most people know about the Loch Ness monster. That monster, I was surprised. I came across a site quite a long time ago where it's a readers group, and they specifically read books set in other times and places to learn about those times and places. And they were wondering why I named the lake, or the loch as it's called, obviously, after the monster. And so just in case anyone doesn't know, the loch is Loch Ness, and that's why it's called the Loch Ness Monster. So I guess there were some people who didn't know that. So, but anyway, yeah, I've been to Urquhart Castle, which is what Glenmiril is based on. I've been to just a ton of these places. When you get farther into the books, there's a scene where Sean and Neil stay in a Roman fort, ruins. And I've been to those ruins. I've been to Carlisle, which is in northern England, where they end up going to spy. So I've been in the castle there that they end up in. I've been in the space where the orchards are, where Sean nearly gets caught. So yeah, I've made the trip there 5 times and gone to most of the places that are in the book to see them firsthand.
That's really amazing, the time and the effort, after I dropped my phone, that you put into, and it shows, too, when you read these books, it shows how it you're immersed in the world. I remember reading it and feeling it as I was reading it, like especially the last battle scene.
Yeah.
It just, I felt I was there.
Oh,
and that
that's
shows
so good
work you put into it.
Yeah. And I've been to, now the truth is they don't know exactly where all the battle was. They have a pretty good idea, but there are several competing theories. And so I have been to that remaining battlefield. I've been to Bannockburn. The battle is called the Battle of Bannockburn, but a burn is a little creek. And so this little kind of stream is called basically the Bannock Stream. And so I've been to that stream. I've seen where it is. So, yes, I've been right there and seen the whole setting where the reenactment would happen and all. So I'm glad that came out. But, you know, one of the reasons that I really put so much effort into the research is years ago when I was, 23 or 24, my husband at the time was, he's from Ireland, and he was reading a book about Robin Hood. And all of a sudden, he just threw the book down and he's like, I can't keep reading this. I said, what's wrong? Why not? And he said, they're eating potatoes. And my being an American, like, I knew nothing about potatoes. Well, he's from Ireland. He knows everything about potatoes. He's like, there were not potatoes in medieval England. They only came from the world. And so, you know, I really saw firsthand, if somebody knows a detail and you blow it in your book, it really does destroy their suspension of disbelief. And you've ruined the book because they've been yanked out of that time and place. And they are completely aware now that they're in a fictional world, and they struggle with that. So that was a really telling moment for me, just about how important every single detail is, how important it is to look up. Did they have buttons or not? Because somebody knows if they did. And if you put buttons in where there weren't buttons, it is going to cause that reaction to someone. So I do try to be very, very careful.
How did you get the inspiration to write the series in the beginning?
It's several things. So the first thing is, there is a book called In the Keep of Time. It's actually a children's book. It's written by Margaret J. Anderson. And one of the exciting things about writing this series is I actually ended up speaking to her. She's in her 80s now, and she lives out in Oregon. But I ended up speaking to her, and I think it was a result of talking to her, and, you know, she found out people still read and love her book, that she did reprint it and got it out on ebook. And so that was a thrill. And I believe she got it available in Smailholm Castle or Smailholm Keep. And so anyway, this story was just my favorite childhood book. And it's about these four siblings from England, and they're left with their great aunt in Scotland. I'm trying to remember the name of the town. And I'm a little surprised at myself. I've forgotten it now. But anyway, the keep is called Smailholm Keep, and it's just this tower. It's a medieval tower. And so these kids go into it a few times, and one day they go in and see a shining, and they go in, and long story short, they come back down, and they're in medieval Scotland. They're actually in the 1500s. And so this was just one of these things that just stayed with me, this idea that you go into a building and it takes you to another time. And so obviously that's exactly what happens in my book, except that it's two men who are both in the tower and they switch places in time. So that was one thing. The second thing is that I was actually, in a previous life, I was a trombone player, and I majored in music on trombone, and when you play that instrument, you're almost invariably going to try playing a piece of music called Bluebells of Scotland, which you might recognize as the name of the series or the first book. And so the point of this piece, it's an old folk song, but years ago in the 1800s, people thought that the slide trombone, as they called it then, really couldn't do much. And so this man, Arthur Pryor, took this folk song and he wrote a theme and variations on the folk song. And it's very complex and it moves fast and there are triplets and 16th notes and it goes down to what we call the pedal tones in trombone, which just as an interesting side note, the pedal tones are so low that on the old TVs that have the tubes in them, if you stood in front of a TV and played a pedal tone, it would make the whole screen wave. It was really cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's an incredibly low, low sound that just has these vibrations. It's wild. And so this piece makes all these octave jumps. The trombone has, I want to say, like about 4 to 5 octaves. I'm forgetting now exactly, but I think about 4.5 octave range. So it's got an incredible range for a professional. And so anyway, this was a really neat piece of music that I worked on when I was in high school. And one day I looked up the lyrics back before there was the internet, so I must have gone to the library or something. And I looked up the lyrics, and it's about waving banners, noble deeds, and streaming banners. And that's kind of the kind of book I would like to read, you know, about noble deeds and streaming banners and all these gallant things happening. And so, well, obviously, if that's the kind of book I want to read, that's the kind of book I want to write. And that was kind of the second thing. And then the third thing, you know, who knows where these things come from. I just had this image one day of this man who was so arrogant that he would gamble away his livelihood and then try and con his girlfriend out of her grandmother's heirloom ring to pawn the ring to get the trombone back. And anybody who reads the book will recognize that scene in the book where Sean's drunk and, you know, he's got this legendary luck and he is thrilled with the story, how people are going to tell this story forever. And he puts his trombone on the table when he's finally losing everything. And he's like, you know, my luck is legendary. I'm going to win it back. And he doesn't. He loses. And then he has to get the trombone back because he's got this big concert the next day and the conductor is already furious with him. And, you know, he just doesn't care because he thinks he can get away with anything at this stage in his life. And so anyway, those were the three inspirations, the story about time travel and then this song, Bluebells of Scotland, and then this image of this man gambling away his livelihood. And so I sat down, started writing, and this is what came out.
So the Bluebells doesn't just stop, though, at the series. Now, you've done a couple of other books, nonfiction books, related to that series. Tell us about those.
Yeah. Well, there's really only one that's specifically related to this series, and that is called Food and Feast. And let me see if I can remember the whole subtitle. Food and Feast in the World of the Bluebells Chronicles, a gastronomic, historic, poetical, musical romp in time. And time, of course, is spelled T-H-Y-M-E. And so what I did with Food and Feast, I actually had a publicist, and her name is Dina, and she had asked me to put this together because she loved all these scenes of food and throughout the series where they're eating and where I'm describing the various things they're eating. And so in Food and Feast, I go through and I take various scenes where they're eating. And so I'll give the scene, let me see, I'm trying to think. I think there might be one about the apple orchard or something like that. And so I'll give a little bit of history. I might give a poem from medieval times or say a Robert Burns poem. And then I'll always give a recipe. And Here's an example. I think I have a scene in there, one of the many scenes where the army is moving and where they're cooking their food over a fire. And so there's a little kind of just one page, two paragraphs about the Chillingham cattle and about how the cattle they knew are actually fairly different from the cattle we know. And that's another thing I did. I've actually been to Chillingham, which is a castle in England, and they have there this amazing herd of medieval cattle that, for reasons that they cannot fully understand, this herd of cattle has interbred with itself for 800 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that that should cause problems, all this inbreeding. But for some reason with this herd, it hasn't. And if I remember correctly, they said that these cattle are all basically clones of each other because of 800 years of inbreeding.
But oh, wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. But what's interesting about them is that you can go there and they'll actually take you on a tour through these fields and you can see what medieval cattle looked like. And they're significantly smaller than what we have because over the past, you know, I'm not sure how many hundred years, we've done all this genetic, I don't want to say genetic engineering, but we've bred them to be bigger and bigger and bigger. And so you go there, and we're used to cattle of a certain size, and you go see these cattle, and they're, I'm not going to say small, but maybe about a third smaller than what we're used to, maybe a little more than that. And so they might stand, I was trying to guess, you can't get too close to them because they are wild animals, and I believe the males especially can be aggressive. So they've got all these gates that you can get out of, and the tour guide will take you in, take you around the field, but if the cattle start to get too close, she'll take you right out one of the gates right away because they don't want to lose their tour, you know. As nearly as I could figure out, I was kind of measuring the fence post compared to my shoulder and then watching when the cattle came closer. And so I think these cattle are only about up to my shoulder, and I'm 5'6". So, you know, I'm not short, but I'm not tremendously tall either.
Uh-huh.
And I think that these cattle's shoulders or their heads would be about the same height as my shoulder. So that would give you a rough idea of how big these are. And so that would be one thing that I have in Food and Feast is something about how the cattle were different. I have sections on how they ate on the trail. So among these, many hundreds of books I have in my house, I have maybe about a dozen on medieval cooking. On one of them is actually, let's see, I have A Feast of Ice and Fire, which is recipes based on, I think it's the Game of Thrones, that somebody did some research into medieval cooking. I have one on Lewis and Clark. There is, I believe, an extant copy of their records that they kept on their trip, which includes recipes. And so somebody put together a cookbook of Lewis and Clark, and I figured, okay, eating in the wilderness, I know Lewis and Clark is not medieval Scotland, but there have to be some similarities in how you eat in the wilderness. And
mm-hmm.
So I use it as a resource, you know, and I'm quite sure I must have said in the book that this is where some of it was coming from, you know, acknowledging it's not quite the same. I have multiple medieval cookbooks. I'm looking at them right now. I've got some of Hildegard von Bingen's books. So one of the things I include in there, I'm trying to remember if it involved mushrooms or apples, but I do talk about some of Hildegard von Bingen's theories on food and what various foods will do for you as far as remedies. Oh, I have Cookies of Joy in there, and those come from Hildegard. And so she recommended, let me see if I can remember this, cinnamon, nutmeg, and ground cloves. And Hildegard, by the way, is from the 1200s, just to put her in perspective. And she has all these, I think she wrote 9 books on biology and food and vegetables and all these things known about. So anyway, she said cinnamon, nutmegs, and ground cloves. You make cookies with these. And today we call them cookies of joy. She didn't. But she did say that if you eat these every day, it will improve your mood because there's something about those three spices.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
So that's the sort of thing that's in food and tea. And, yeah, a lot of research into that, too.
So the second book is Go Home and Practice Music Record Book.
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
that about?
And that, it's only interesting if you're a musician. I use that for my music students. And what it is, it's kind of the system I use. It's something I learned from a harp player, and I can't believe her name comes straight to mind. Her name is Rhonda Jaramillo, and she played harp for the Bremerton Symphony back in Washington when I lived there. And she was very big on using metronome, this idea of you start slow, you work in small sections, and you do it over and over and over again, and you only slowly increase the tempo, and every single time you have to be able to do it perfect, and it has to feel easy. And so I do play multiple instruments. I play piano, harp, I play flute, clarinet, saxophone. I used to play trombone. It's a long story, I don't anymore. I teach about a dozen instruments, and this is kind of a method that I've used to learn all these instruments, and it's very effective. And so I used to just write down assignments on a notebook and kept, you know, I'd write down, you have to start at this tempo, you, and kids wouldn't use it. So I found that when I made a book that actually sets it up, here's your assignment, here's your tempo, mark down how many times you did each day, the kids who use this really do improve much more quickly because they get to learn a system that works rather than you just sit down and play it and, play it 2-3 times and hope it gets better. They come to learn that there's a way to practice correctly. So that's what that is. And then I do have a book called, I think it's called Creative Writing, A Few Thoughts. And that is something I use. I do teach writing classes at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, which I think just changed its name to Minneapolis College. So I use that for my students there, and someday I'm going to get that into a form and put that out on Amazon. But and then I'm working on, it's called Tell Me a Tale of Alba, and that will be stories from Scottish history and Scottish folklore. And I'm also putting together a book called Poetry for Writers of Prose. So I'm keeping pretty busy. And then I have a couple other novels I'm working on, too. So I'm
and,
very busy.
And you're a publisher. So let's talk about Laura Vasica, the publisher, and Gabriel's Horn. Mm-hmm. What has been going on with Gabriel's Horn? Tell us how you've grown, how it is to be a publisher, the troubles, the joys that go into that.
Well, to be honest, I'm keeping the company very small at this point. I was working with someone else, and now I'm kind of working, well, I'm entirely working on my own, and that hinders things a little bit. But I have, I have multiple authors, but two in particular. Sean Brink has a series called, I'm trying to remember, it's a Christian apocalyptic series about the end times, and called I can't believe I forgot the names of his books. Anyway, Sean Brink.
It's Space Between.
Yeah, that's right. Space Between. So his three books are out. I have Keith Ferrario is a horror novelist, and he had four books out under his he pronounces it Samhain. I imagine they do, too, and that's very distressing to me because it's a Gaelic word, and it should be pronounced Savin. The M-H makes a sound. And I know this because my daughter's name is Kiva, C-A-O-I-M-H-E. And as I said, I study Gaelic, so the M-H makes a D sound. But anyway, that's a sidetrack. Anyway, Samhain closed its doors, and so he's in the process of republishing his books with me, and I think he has the first two out, and I'm waiting on the next two. And then everybody in my writers group has published their books under Gabriel Thorne, so we have quite a collection of some mysteries, nonfiction, some kind of sci-fi type things, quite an eclectic collection. And then one that I'm really excited about, Dan Blum has published with me a book called Defeat Say Run. And I met him on, I believe it was a poetry forum. And so we were both anonymous. You know, I didn't know who he was. And we got to talking about writing. And his book sounded really fascinating. It was the story of this old man who's 85 years old. And he goes out, kind of like Gilligan's Island, he goes out on a yacht cruise with his wealthy neighbor, and they're caught in a storm, and they crash on an island. And so it's this old man and these six other survivors. And this story alternates every chapter. One chapter tells about their life on the island, how they're kind of trying to create a society, and the troubles they have, and the ways they work together, and just kind of the foibles of human nature, how here they are stranded on a desert island and they're still arguing about capitalism and socialism, you know, and all these things that don't matter because there are seven of them, but darn it, they're going to argue it to the death, you know. So it's kind of pointing out just our human foibles and foolishness at times. And then the chapters in between, the character is named Hans Jaeger, and it's telling about how Hans was 13, I believe in about 1936 or 39, something like that. So he grew up in pre-war Germany, and he came of age as Hitler was coming to power. And he had a kind of a girlfriend at school when he was maybe 16 or so, 15, 16, who was Jewish. And we see the scene of Kristallnacht, and we see how he's running to warn her, and she and her mother are much more worried about him because it's illegal to talk to a Jew. Now, this girl is actually Christian, but her father was Jewish, and so therefore, according to Hitler, she is. And so they're urging him, you know, it's illegal for you to be seen here. She'll be fine. They're just going to ask questions, but you need to get out of here. And so he runs out the window and runs away, and of course, she's taken away by the Gestapo, and so he lives with that guilt, and he later joins the Wehrmacht, and it goes through the reasons why he would do this and how he's torn between his mother's politics and his father's politics, which are complete opposite. It's really a profound story. And it's funny, too. Dan is, he's a poet, he's a novelist, and he is just an absolutely brilliant writer. He's got a way with words. His poems are probably the best modern poetry I've ever read. And
oh, wow.
It's just his craft is so honed, so talented. And yet they're funny and they're serious. You know, he's a brilliant writer. So anyway, the exciting thing about Dan Blum and this novel, Defeat Say Run, is it was actually optioned for a movie, I want to say about a year ago, a year and a half maybe. And so I just talked to him a couple weeks ago, and that is still very definitely possibly moving forward. So one of the things I've learned in this business is because you're optioned for a movie, it's only a minority that are optioned for movies that ever actually see the big screen. But there are some positive things happening there. And so I'm very hopeful that a book I published will actually be turned into a movie. And
that is exciting.
One of the more exciting things in my life. So
wow.
That's my life. Sure.
So how do you handle running a publishing company and dealing with authors and marketing? What's that like in your life?
Well, as I said, I'm now doing it myself, and so I'm kind of trying to get back onto a schedule of actually pushing and marketing these things, the books, of trying to keep up with everything, and that will change as I get back to a lot more marketing, and I've just started that. So let's just say it's very time consuming, and it takes a lot of organization, because as you know, there are so many sites, there are so many places that you have to have accounts, and just a lot to do. Yeah, it keeps me very busy.
How do you find time with running the publishing company, teaching a class in both music and writing, and then doing your own writing? How do you do your writing? How do you fit that in?
Well, I'd say that depends on the day. I do a lot of list making, and I find that if I can sit down and make a list, I do fairly well. I'm finding that I really don't need more than 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night. I just kept up with myself. I kept waking up early, and I'd like be gritting my teeth and squeezing my eyes shut, saying, "I need 8 hours of sleep. Everybody says I do. I'm going to go back to sleep." And I finally said, "This is ridiculous. You know what? I'm not falling back asleep." I took some advice from Sean, my character Sean. He has severe insomnia. And he gets up and he works in the night, and that's part of how he gets everything done, how he marketed all this orchestra, how he writes all this music, he does all these arrangements. He can't sleep at night because of these things that are eating at him, and so he just gets up and works. And I thought, well, you know, I should take a clue from him. I should do that. And, you know, what's the point of lying here awake, unable to sleep? So I figure I can take a nap later, but bit by bit, I realized, you know, if I sleep 5 hours at night, which is about what I sleep, I get up and I work in the morning, and then about noon, I take a nap. I sleep for maybe 45 minutes to an hour, and I get up and go back to work. And, you know, and then one of the things that I've often said when people ask me this question is I got really good at using just small pieces of time. So, for instance, I pick my daughter up from work every day, and so I'll go out there and I'll bring my laptop, and if she's not done yet, I'll just sit in the restaurant and I'll just work on my writing for, you know, 10, 15 minutes, half an hour, however long, until she's done. And then we'll get in the car and we'll drive to Aldi, and I'll sit in the car and I'll work on editing while she runs in with the list and gets the groceries. You know, wherever I am, I have my laptop, so if the student doesn't show up for lessons, I have half an hour, and I'll either use it to work on my own practicing, my own music, or I'll open the laptop and I'll spend half an hour doing some marketing or doing some editing. So I use all these little bits and pieces of time.
You're an amazing woman, Laura.
Well, thank you.
So, and on top of this, I want everybody to know, Laura has 9 children, right?
Yes, we do. Yep. Yep.
And
I have 9 children and a daughter-in-law and a grandson. I have a grandson now. I don't know if I told you that.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. He's about 6 months old. He was born in July.
So in between all of this, you still have all of your children that you're dealing with. I mean,
yeah.
You are, and your writing is incredible too. So I just want everybody to know, like I said, I look at Laura's writing equal to Diana Gabaldon's and of the same quality.
Speaking of Diana Gabaldon, if I can put in a plug here, I will actually be, what is it, the 31st, in 2 weeks, I will be at the Amelia Island Book Expo in Fernandino Beach, Florida, and Diana Gabaldon will be there. So I am hoping to meet her.
That would be incredible if you can do that. I can't wait to hear how that meeting goes.
Yeah, that would be fun. I actually did see her speak once. She was at Harmar Mall here in, well, over in St. Paul. I'm in Minneapolis. And it was kind of funny. It was quite a few years ago, and so it was one of the first years or one of the first times that I actually left the kids at home. They were getting just old enough that I felt okay leaving the littler kids with the older kids. And so I got there, and I had my book, and, of course, it was packed. And she invited anybody with young children to come first in line. And I was like, oh, darn. The one time, first time in my life, I go out and leave the little kids home. And I could have been first in line. But they were all so young enough that I looked at that line and I went, ah, you know, I came to hear her speak. I heard her speak. It was great. But I also don't want to leave the older kids too long to deal with that many younger kids. And so I went home without getting my book signed. And I was just cleaning out my office today. I found a couple of her books. So I set them aside to pack up and take Florida with me. And yeah, maybe I'll ask her to sign them. So we'll see.
So if anybody wants to find you, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that I take the time to – give that information. Where would they find you?
Okay, I am at a lot of places. So let me see. My website is www.bluebellschronicles.com. You can actually get to the same site by bluebellstrilogy.com or lauravosica.com, V as in Victor, O-S-I-K-A. That's my website. My blog is http://bluebellstrilogy.blogspot.com. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/laura.bosica.author. Again, Bosica, it's a Czech name, just in case you're interested, Bohemian. It is V as in Victor, O-S-I-K-A. I'm at Twitter, which is twitter.com/laura.bosica. And if you want to learn Gaelic, I am at, let's see, it is www.gaelicwordaday.wordpress.com. And I'm trying to think, yeah, there it is, gaelicwordaday, all one word, .wordpress.com. And I think I probably have a few other places, but if you go to all of those, you'll find me at the other places. Like I have a Pinterest site, and I think that's pinterest.com/lauravosica, too, all one word. So I'm pretty easy to find. There aren't that many Laura Vosicas.
Very cool. In the last couple of minutes, what advice would you give to new writers?
The best thing I have done is to join a writer's critique group. So I am part of Knight Writers of Maple Grove, and they have been together, the original members, for about 30 years now. I've been with them for 12 years, and they are just, they're a very talented bunch of people, and it's incredibly helpful to get outside, an outside ear or an outside eye, to listen to your writing or to read your writing. And there are places online that do this where you can join and trade critiques with other people. I would say almost any city or town, you can probably find some sort of writer's critique group. And what we do is we get together, we take turns, a chapter or a few scenes from our piece, and then we get feedback from everybody. Oh, you know, that doesn't sound like how someone would really talk, or would they really react like that? Or, you know, it can be positive, like I really love the way the descriptions are given. I feel like I'm right there. So they have just been invaluable to me. And I think that's, you know, the number one thing. You should belong to a writer's critique group.
Well, Laura, it was wonderful to catch up with you again. Looking
you
forward
too.
To seeing the next things, and I do need to get a copy of Feast and Food.
Okay. All right.
And
I can send that to you.
Oh, I would love it.
Okay.
Stay warm, my friend.
Trying. Yeah. I'm huddled in front of the heater here. So, all right.
All right, you take care of yourself, and we will be talking to you again.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.